Up till now, Billy's experiences and contacts have pretty much all been on the planet Earth. But things are changing now. He's up to his 31st contact, which takes place on July 17, 1975. Just a couple of days before this, Semyasi has contacted Billy telepathically and asked him to prepare for a surprise for a rather long mission, that she and the others have decided to take Billy to the Pleiades, and that they have some other things to do, and they're on a certain mission of their own, and they plan to take Billy with them for a period of time, actually amounting to several days. But they mentioned to him that he would only be gone for about 30 hours. So apparently they plan to return him, somehow kind of making some sort of time shift. So the time comes, and Billy's ready. He gets some extra film together and his camera, and he heads out for the location. He, again, is feeling the familiar telepathic cooling on his forehead, receives a message from Semyasi, hears the voices in his head, and he's off to the contact. Well, she picks him up. First of all, she's on the ground when he gets there. The ship is already parked, and they talk for a minute, and she explains to him what they're going to do, that they're going to go for a ride, and that they're going to go visit several other planets, and ask him if he has his film with him, which he does. So she says, well, all right, let's get going. So they walk over to where the beam ship is parked, and Billy notices once again that there are no steps involved or anything. They just seem to float right up into the hatch of the ship. Now the hatch is in the bottom center of the ship, and they pull right up inside of the ship. Billy's got his camera ready, and before he can hardly even get oriented, the ship is already leaving the ground, and the hatch is still open. So he manages to snap a picture or two in the open hatch of the ground as it's kind of racing away from them. And already they're pulling away from Earth. Well, she informs Billy that the first part of their trip today, that she's going to give him a ride to Venus and Mercury. And they're going to fly by those planets, and she has some things to show him. And he says, well, will I be able to take pictures this time? And she says, yeah. Now, we know the difficulty quite sometimes that your camera has inside of the ship and that you have focusing that little camera. So they had designed something for him to help take the pictures so he wouldn't have to take them through the sight screen, the little board windows, they call them, on the ship, which sometimes are in different colors because of the atmosphere, the radiation outside, and mess the pictures up. Billy, as a matter of fact, snaps a couple of pictures as they're leaving planet Earth on that day, and they come out kind of green, just like she said they would, because the board windows reflect green in our atmosphere. They're orange on the outside, and as the light comes through them, it appears green on the inside. So whenever he takes pictures inside out through the window in an atmosphere, he gets this green thing. There are a couple of pictures in his collection. You can see the ship in front of them as they pull them out of Earth, and there's another one far out in front. So there's all three of them leaving that particular day. Well, they made for him something, a special screen for photographing. And Billy said it looked like a plain, just a sheet of glass, almost, with kind of a border around it. And she says, well, this will allow you to get pictures on the surface of the planet and other areas without taking the pictures through the windows of the ship, which doesn't always work well. So Billy looked at the glass and held it in his hands, and he said it was about 50 centimeters square. And when he looked at the glass, you could see outside the ship. It apparently somehow had the ability to, wherever you kind of aimed the glass, it would see outside the ship. Something much like a video camera mounted on the outside of the ship might show up on a television screen. So he said, well, how do I work this? And she says, well, there's really nothing to do. You can just aim your camera at this little screen, this plate of glass, and take a picture of whatever's on the plate. And that should allow you to get a little better picture. So he's kind of fiddling with that and looking around the ship, and they're on their way to Venus, which it isn't going to take very long to get there. He's noticing all around the ship, and it's circular inside, that there are all sorts of instruments and screens and all over the ship. The middle of the ship, there's kind of a round table that has a lot of instruments on that. And over on the, I guess you'd call it the console, where she actually controls the ship, there's a lot of different screens there, but he notices that they're quite different than like our television screens, which are normally flat, just one-dimensional things, that the screens inside of the ship seem to be kind of like holograms or some sort of 3D effect. that when you look at the picture on the screen, you don't get the effect of looking at a screen. It actually, excuse me, almost looks like you're looking at the real thing. So they're already arriving at Venus, and she apparently slows the ship down, and he takes a couple of pictures on his little sight screen of the planet as they're approaching it. Then she cautions him and says that they're going to fly down on the surface of the planet now, but he won't be able to use the screen that they've made for him for photographing, which is kind of curious. And he says, why? He says, well, it also picks its heat sensitive, and that the planet Venus is very hot. In some parts it's up to 500 degrees Celsius on the surface temperature, and that this screen somehow is affected by heat. It can sense cold and withstand cold very well, but it doesn't withstand heat very well. So he wouldn't be able to use this screen for these particular pictures of Venus, although he can use them for pictures in the rest of the mission, the flight. But so here he has to go over and he takes pictures of Venus on the sight screens, these 3D or hologram screens, whatever they are, inside of the ship. They proceed to lower the craft down. The beam ship lowers down in the clouds because Venus is covered with a cloud bank. And Billy kind of notices how long it takes to slowly sink down through the clouds. When they finally come out into open air where they can see the planet, he is told by Samyasi that they're about 40 kilometers still above the surface of Venus. He notices right away it looks just like our moon. It's just craters and kind of a sandy, rocky-looking desert sort of thing, just kind of like the way we see the moon. And this is the same way that Samyasi had told him that it would be, that it really looks just like our moon with a cloud bank all around it. He notices that the surface of Venus is kind of very flat, just like she said, around the equator. It's kind of smooth. And he says, will I be able to take pictures of other parts of Venus? And she said, sure, that's just exactly what she had in mind. And she immediately, the beam ship, just starts skimming over the surface of Venus, and they circle Venus 3-4 times, something like that, and Billy's snapping several pictures as they go. Then immediately the beam ship just snaps out into space, and within a few minutes they rush right over to the planet Mercury. And it says in the notes that nothing really eventful happened there. He just snaps a couple of pictures of Mercury, and they're off back out into the free space. It mentions in the notes that they also fly by Jupiter and Saturn, which Billy had been to before and already taken a couple of pictures, which didn't come out. So he's able to snap a couple of others. And again, he asks if there's any life forms of any types on these planets, and she remarks, no, there are not. However, there are ETs that have bases on some of the moons. And she didn't elaborate on which ones or what they were doing there, but says that on some of the moons, which are actually solid ground little planet sort of things, that they have equipment there, and that they and other ETs do use that. But other than that, there are no living species there. There are no civilizations there. There are no spirit form life there either. There's no intelligent life of any kind living on Jupiter or Saturn. They're not even real planets. They're just gaseous balls. Okay, very uninhabitable sort of place. So it would make sense that no living creature with any intelligence would want to be there, and for what possible reason? Well, after doing that, they immediately shoot back into the space right around the planet Earth, and Billy's watching on the screens, and he's surprised to see that he sees a little Russian capsule, and he looks closely out there, and he sees the initials CCCR on the back of the capsule. And she explains to him that this is the Russian space capsule that has been shot up into space and is going to hook up with the Apollo capsule quite soon. And they've been very concerned about this, as we mentioned earlier, about the knowledge that would be gained from this particular mission by the Russians and by the Americans. And they did intercede somewhat, causing certain things not to be learned that they felt that we weren't quite ready for yet, that may be misused just for, war or whatever. Billy notices that there are five other saucers like their own around the capsule. I guess it looks kind of crowded up there. And he looks through the window of the beam ship and can't see anything. And then he looks over on the screens inside of the ship and he can see the five other disks. She remarks to begin with that only one of them is Pleiadian, that the other four disks are all from different races that are also interested in what's going on here. And he asks, why can't I see them through the window? says, well, they have their own screens, that distortion screens that protect them from being seen so that they won't be visible, but these screens on the inside of the ship have the ability to see them even though they're cloaked or hidden by these distortion screens. They fly very close by the Russian capsule, and Billy's just kind of surprised how small it is. And he says, I can't believe how little that thing is. It looks like a little flying coffin in there. And she says, well, here, let me show you a little bit closer. And she says, would you like to see inside of the capsule? And he says, how is that possible? And she says, well, with our technology, we can see through the side of the capsule. And immediately on the screens inside of the ship, Billy has seen that. And he's kind of surprised and that suddenly it looks like a cutaway. You can see the two Russians inside of the capsule, and they're kind of laying in a horizontal mode there. And he's a little surprised, and she says, now, calm yourself, don't worry, this isn't having any effect on the capsule, it's just a visual effect. We can see through the side of the thing. And again, he's thinking to himself, you know, what a miserable situation that is to be locked inside that little box, and he's thinking like a coffin. And Semyasi says, careful there, you know, dig deep into your thoughts, that those feelings of fear you have of being in a coffin relate to a previous life somewhere, and that's still some sort of trauma that you're carrying with you into this life. And she tells him to, when he has time, to trouble himself for following those thoughts to find out more about it. And again, he's a little confused because he can't quite grasp what she's talking about yet. Billy immediately notices that the Apollo satellite, which now comes into position, is quite a bit bigger. And she explains, yeah, that's because it carries the linking equipment. Well, the linking takes place, the docking hooks up, and the two Russians float over into the American capsule. And again, they look inside the American capsule, and Billy notices that there's quite a bit more equipment and dials and knobs or whatever in the American capsule. And it's a little bit larger. Then he notices on the screen that one of the Americans bumps his head inside of the capsule. He's apparently not used to the weightlessness and bumps his head and kind of rubs it. And Billy chuckles a little bit and says, you notice, and remarks how cramped the quarters are in there. After that, they don't stay around any longer. Then they take off immediately, and Semyasi reports that some of the others there would be gathering information and they're going to keep watching this event. But they take off. Say they've got, Semyasi says they have a lot of things to do. And she takes off into free space again and says that they're now going to hook up with this great spacer vehicle of theirs and continue their mission. And Billy is kind of left alone, deep in his thoughts for a few minutes as he's just looking out the windows of the ship and looking on the screens. And he kind of gets lost in his thoughts and drifting away. And he suddenly just starts feeling these sensations of tranquility and peace and being at ease. And he's feeling very comfortable out here in space. And he's noticing the many different stars and cloud formations and nebulas which are appearing on some of the screens inside of the ship. And all in all, he's just becoming very, very tranquil and comfortable. And he's having these wonderful feelings of kind of euphoric feeling about him, you know, while he's traveling through the space. And Semyasi again remarks that, you know, once again your feelings are digging deep into feeling comfortable because these somehow connect also to a previous time for you, and tells him to trouble again to search in his thoughts for connecting thoughts about this. So they're always teasing him, you might say, or intriguing him with these ideas of places that he has lived and things that he has done in previous lives, and to search for it himself and try to figure them out. Well, they approach the great spacer, and they call it a great spacer. It'd be similar to what many people call a mothership. It's kind of unusual looking. It's not disc shaped. There's no need for the disc shape out into the free space, because normally the disc shape is used in smaller vehicles where there are planets with atmospheres and water, etc. But out in free space, on a very large craft like this, there's no need for the disc-type shape. So when they approach the great spacer, Billy's a little surprised. Matter of fact, he snaps a picture. It looks kind of like a great big egg. And down at the bottom of the egg, there were either three or four, I forget exactly, smaller kind of round-shaped things that are hooked with the large body of the ship, some sort of connecting bars or something. It's kind of an unusual looking device. And out in front of their ship, as he notices on the screens, there are four or five other discs like theirs, which are also pulling in, it looks like, to like a landing hatch or something, and one of these small balls that's on the bottom of the large one. Off to the left of the screen is a large planet, which looks like Jupiter. And it's suggestive in the notes that this great spacer is somehow in orbit around the planet Jupiter. They fly right into the bottom, this large object, and land in an area, and they stay inside the ship for a few moments. Billy notices that around the ship when they came in, he looks out the window, and he sees that there are hundreds of other ships, all rather similar to the one that they're flying in, and he can also see some strange-looking craft that he can't tell if they're flying things or what, but they are far different shapes than the beam ships. And she explains to Billy that this is their largest ship in its class. It's their newest technology. It's just 4 years old at that point. And that it came about, really, because of Ascot. Billy's a little taken back. He says, Ascot? Do you know Ascot? And because he had contacts with Ascot when he was a teenager, long before he had the contacts with Semyasi. And he was not even aware that Semyasi knew Ascot. And Ascot at the time told him that he would have to keep quiet about his contacts with her and not to discuss them with anyone, which Billy had not. And now suddenly Semyasi's bringing up all about Ascot and suggesting, you know, that that's where they got the technology for the ship. And Billy wants to know, says, well, what do you know about Ascot and me? And Semyasi says, well, I know everything about it, that Ascot and I are friends, and I know all about your contacts earlier. And Billy's kind of surprised. He says, well, I was supposed to keep quiet about that until I received some sort of sign that it would be okay to talk about those contacts. Well, Semyasi says, well, this, consider this the sign. This is it, that at this point from now on, we would like you to take the information that you got from Ascot's contacts and use those, write those up. And she wanted to know then that if Billy still had all of his notes from those contacts from back 56 through 64. And he said, yes, that he did. And she says, well, it would be time for you to get those out and to put those into your notes. Billy wanted to know how she knew Ascot, and Semyasi said that after Billy had had his contacts with Ascot after they'd ended in 1964, Ascot, being aware of the Pleiadians, had made contact with them and come to their planet. And one thing led to another. There became open commerce between their two societies. One of the outshots of that was that Ascot's people, who are called Timmers, provided the Pleiadians with the data and technical knowledge to build the great spacer that they were in. And that it had only been 4 years ago that they finally created this craft. And up until that time, up until about 9 years back, they had never had the ability even for time travel. The Pleiadians themselves are not a race that try very hard for the technical knowledge. They mostly seem to be kind of spiritual people. And even though they're far older and far advanced of us, they had never really made the efforts to break through in the knowledge of time travel. Ascot's people, the Timmers, come from another universe that they call the Dal universe. And their technology, apparently, technically, was far more sophisticated than the Pleiadians, and they had kind of exchanged information with the Pleiadians, swapping their technical knowledge for some of the spiritual things that the Pleiadians knew about. So that's how the great ship came about, and it had time travel capabilities, could move in the future or the past, and that's where the design actually came from. The Timmers, by the way, the Pleiadians estimate that they're probably about 350 years in evolved higher than the Pleiadians are. So at that point, they get outside of the ship, and the air apparently inside of the hangar now is being conditioned, whatever, so they can get out. They get outside of the ship, and Billy's looking around at how big the place is. The ceiling seems to be like 600 to 800 meters high. And almost as far as he can see, there are all sorts of flying craft parked inside there. Almost instantly, a little floating kind of platform pops up beside them, or just drifts over somehow, and Billy likens it about to the size of a Volkswagen. And they just sit down on it. and they start floating up in the air very comfortably, and they're rising almost straight up. And Billy looks up above and sees that there's a rather large hole up in the ceiling, and they seem to be floating up towards that. And she says, yeah, we're going to like go right up into the ship. And Billy, after just a minute or so, he's saying, my, we're getting awful high. How high have we gone up? How big is this thing? And she remarks, well, so far we've gone up 11,000 meters. And he's quite surprised. It's 11,000 meters. That's higher than the highest mountain on Earth, Mount Everest. And she kind of chuckles and says, well, yes, you're right, but the highest mountain on Earth is not Mount Everest. And Billy says, come on, I know my geography. Our highest mountain is Mount Everest. And she says, well, that's because your scientists measure the highest mountain from sea level. We don't. We measure from the center of the planet. And because around the center of the planet, around the equator, it's farther from the center of the planet, that actually the highest mountain on Earth, the way they measure it, would be in Ecuador. And Billy says, oh, yes, I remember from my geography studies, in Ecuador there's a mountain range, or there's a mountain called the Chimborazo or something like that. And she says, now you've got it. That's the highest mountain range on Earth if you measure it from the core of the planet. Well, as they float up, suddenly the little floating craft, whatever it is they're on, just floats over to the side. They're in some sort of great big open area where it just floats up through the ship. And as they're going up, they keep noticing off to the left and the right, there are all these different kind of levels. And they're going by, you know, many of them. And suddenly they float over to the side, and there's sets right down on the ground, and they get off. Billy steps out, and he's just knocked out. What he's looking at, he says, looks like the most beautiful garden he's ever seen. They're in a huge area which serves as a recreation area for the people on the ship. She remarks that there's 143,000 people living on this great spacer, and that it is completely self-contained. It contains everything you need, almost like living on a normal world. It has outside recreational areas, lakes, streams, they can fly. They can grow all of their own food. They are completely self-sufficient on this great spacer. And this area that they're in is kind of a recreational facility. It's an outside area with real mountains, streams, lakes, everything. And it's huge, almost as far as you can see in here. Billy is just flabbergasted by the size of this thing. And he wants to know how big this craft really is. And she remarks that, well, the diameter of it, where we're right now in the main part of the ship, the diameter of it is 17,182 meters, which is over 10 miles in diameter. So you get some idea how big this thing is. And it's much taller. I don't know the exact height it is, but it's far taller than it is wide because it's kind of an egg shape. So the thing could be as much as maybe 20 miles high. Well, she's explaining all about the recreational facilities and so forth, and what their next thing that they're going to do. She says that that the leader of the spacer, that would be their next stop, that they're going to go up to the top of the ship, on the dome of the ship, where actually it's kind of like the flight center, I guess, the control center where they fly this, and that Billy is going to be allowed to meet the leader, who is an Ishwish, a king of wisdom, who actually is in charge of the ship, the leader of the ship. And Billy immediately says, uh-oh, I'm going to meet a god, huh? And he says, I hope he doesn't expect me to hit my knees and, you know, get down on my knees and bow down to this guy just because he's the god of your people. And he's going on and on, just very politely so, but he's making remarks about, you know, in our folklore, when people think of gods, they think of worship, and they get very rattled. And he's real concerned that this god's going to expect him to hovel or worship him or something. And Semyasi starts to break out kind of laughing. And Billy's still going on about how he doesn't expect to grovel at all for any great god, no matter who he is. Suddenly there's this kind of loud boom in the air, and it's kind of like he hears this huge laughter, kind of like a roar across the place that they're at. And he says, what in the world was that? And she says, well, that the great god, the Ishwish, up on top was actually listening in to their thoughts. And he also thought it was funny that Billy thought that he would be, you know, a person like that. That Semyasi explains in their society that people become Ishwishes because of the wisdom that they attain. They become a king of wisdom. but they are not revered or thought of as any better or less than anyone else, that everyone has equal value on the world and they gain respect for their knowledge. But there's no groveling, there's no worship, and to be an Ishwish, a king of wisdom, which means God in our language, on their planet, doesn't mean that they're anything particularly special. You can still talk to these people, and they don't put them on any great pedestal and worship them. Well, Semyasi says, follow me now, and they go over to another open area where there's another one of these little floating platforms. They get back on it, and they float all the way up to the top. And they're in some sort of great big kind of circular open area where there's a lot of other platforms going up and down. And they just float up to the top to this great dome. And when they get up to the top, they stay on this little platform and they're just floating along this huge open area. First thing that Billy notices is he looks up to the ceiling and he can see the stars. And he's immediately kind of surprised that looks like we're outside. There's no ceiling. And she remarks that no, that through these high technology distortion beams they have, they can actually, they project something at the ceiling and it allows them to see right through it. That actually there is a metal ceiling there that's very strong, very hard, and protects them, so not to worry about it. As they're floating along, and Billy notices that it must be several kilometers distance long because he can't even see the end of this. And there are all sorts of people up there working, doing different things. And he notices right away that there are some very peculiar looking humans. And it's explained to him that these are droids. They're organic people that the Pleiadians grow on purpose for specific functions. It would be like what we think of as an android. And Billy's just watching this as they're floating along. He even notices that there are some droids, it looks like, built right into the equipment where they are only like half a person. And these are beings, she says, that they've learned how to organically grow a brain and program it so it can do particular functions. And they're all over the place like this. Well, they're moving along and she's explaining to him more about the equipment and where they're at and more about the ship. And Billy glances ahead and he sees like a big kind of horseshoe-shaped area that they're slowly approaching. And there's a man standing there that's kind of looking at them. He appears to be about 70, 75 years old. And he just kind of gently smiles as they approach it. And they step off the little floating platform. And Semyasi immediately runs over to this fellow and grabs him. And they're hugging and they give each other a big kiss. And they look very, very excited to see each other. And Billy notices that he has kind of a sinking feeling. I think he's just a little bit of jealousy kind of creeps in there because he's very, very fond of Semyasi, and whether he knows it or not, he really has strong, heartfelt feelings for her. And so he feels a little bit of a sinking feeling here, a little rivalry, he comments in his notes. And Semyasi walks back over with this elderly fellow and says, I'd like for you to meet Ptah. She says, this is my father. And Billy is immediately kind of embarrassed that he was feeling that way. And she says, this is my father, Ptah. And Ptah immediately starts speaking to Billy. And Billy's kind of surprised right away that he knows German. And Ptah says, very nice to meet you. Just the usual cordialities are exchanged between them. And Billy notices right away that he speaks great German. And he says, no, I don't at all. I'm just wearing this little translator device here that takes my thoughts and converts it to whatever language that I wanted to, any language that we have on our program bank. And Ptah asked Billy if he speaks any other languages, because Ptah doesn't speak German, but he speaks Greek and a few others, and wants to know if Billy can speak Greek, because he'd like to turn the thing off and they could practice. And Billy says, well, I speak a little Greek, but not very well. And he says, well, that's okay. So he shuts off the little translator box that he's wearing, and Ptah begins to speak this old Greek. Well, Billy is a little surprised that he can actually kind of understand it, and they give him a little device to wear also, so that when he thinks in his own language of German, it comes out in perfect Greek. So they're exchanging things in Greek. Ptah is speaking Greek himself. Billy's thinking German, and it comes out Greek, so Ptah can understand it. So this was how they were conversing. Ptah mentions to him that his name is a little unusual and asks if Billy understands the historical reference to the name Ptah back on Earth history. that it was used by some Egyptian, he says, leaders. He says he has an old ancestor named Ptah that was used that name, but Billy wasn't familiar with it. And he says perhaps he would look that up when he got a chance. Well, they discuss a few things about the ship, and Ptah explains more about what's going on, invites him to sit down, and explains to him that they have a certain mission that they're on, that they're going to be making different stops in different places today where they're going, and he invites Billy to sit down. There's a couple of kind of chairs there in this big horseshoe area, and Billy's looking at all the equipment, and suddenly he looks up. He's looking at the top, at the ceiling, actually at the stars, because you can see right through the ceiling, and notices suddenly that the stars seem to almost blur for a second, like they're streaked, and then they straighten right back up again. And he says, what happened there? And Ptah explains that, well, they've just made what we would think of as like a jump in space, that they have just gone from the area they were at in the earthly space, that they just made a jump through hyperspace into the Pleiades now. And that's all it took. There was just like just a little secondary kind of blurring of the stars. And Ptah is beginning to explain to him a little bit how that worked. He also reminds Billy that they've managed to stop about 153 million kilometers away. They're farther than that, but that's as close as they can get to the end planets. Because, again, these great spacers, like some of their smaller ships, when they make these jumps into hyperspace, then it has an effect on the orbit of the planet. So they had to make sure that they were quite a ways away. Well, as Ptah is explaining to Billy a little bit how this works, he's reminding him that, as it was explained to him earlier, that the universe is made up of coarse matter and fine matter. Coarse matter being the solid, real matter part of the universe, and fine matter are the many different energy levels that also exist in the universe. And that he was giving him a brief rundown again of how it works, that when you make the jumps through hyperspace, first there's this great speed which is obtained, and they use the great speed, of course, to increase the mass-speed correlation, so there's this tremendous pressure in on the ship that's held back by the screens. And then what they do is they drop the screens, increase the velocity, and break into hyperspace. And once they do that, they can create these time dilations, where they can actually, the ship then is in a fine matter world, and it is no longer solid. They can then project or program the ship somehow to go where it needs to go, and then it comes back into the coarse matter world, wherever it is that they want to be, and it's instantaneous. Time is paralyzed there for a second, so no time is really going by. All that you really notice, he says, is sometimes in the body you can feel the feeling of the body coming back together, because just for a part second, it was no longer physical when they've broken into hyperspace and moved into this fine matter world. So Billy's real intrigued about that. And as he's sitting there talking to Ptah, during their course of conversation about a variety of things, which was mostly about Billy's mission and how he was doing and how it was affecting him, they made another jump, and again, Billy felt some unusual sensation. And Ptah was picking up on that in his thoughts, and he says, I'm noticing that you're picking up on something here, that you're sensing just a little bit of what it's like to be in the fine matter world. And Billy says, yeah, I'm something I never really experienced before quite like this, that each time we make a jump and break into this fine matter world, or null time, whatever you want to call it, that there's a very short sensation or connection to that somehow that feels kind of pleasant. And Ptah remarks that, yes, that what you're doing is that, remember that you are body and spirit, that when the body is no longer physical, that the spirit then has the ability to feel the sensation at being close to eternity or creation, whatever you want to call it. And that just for a part second there, you know, that you are a total spiritual being and you're no longer in the physical body. And he was very surprised that Billy could actually sense that. Because he says most people in the Pleiades, they have to be experiences several times and have it explained to them before they really pick up on what it is. And he could tell from Billy's thoughts that Billy was already figuring out what was going on spiritually, that his spirit was somehow touching eternity. and sensing the great creational energy of the creation itself. And Patah thought that was rather amazing that he could actually do that. And then he continued to explain to Billy that he really shouldn't be surprised that he could do that, because he actually was quite aware of Billy's high evolvement. And again, evolvement refers to number of lifetimes and wisdom learned in those lifetimes. So it's not like Billy is better or less than anyone. He's older. He's lived more lifetimes, and contained within his spirit is the wisdom of things learned in those lifetimes, and that's what spiritual evolvement is. Again, that is the reason for our material life, to gather information with our senses and feed the truth from the result of that logic to your spirit. Your spirit's always open for business, paying attention to what you're doing all the time, so you might want to start considering, as you're going through life and you're doing all these things in the material world, that there's an attempt always to obtain spiritual growth, that your spirit is inside always paying attention to what you're doing, so be careful what you try to feed it. There was a short conversation about how the ship can actually move in time now, that because of the technology given to them by Ascot's people, the Timmers, that this great spacer not only could make these great jumps, it could paralyze time, but they finally had learned to understand a little bit about how to make a time shift. And he began to explain to Billy a little bit how what happens is when you make the jump from hyperspace and create these time dilations, that it's very important that then when you're in the fine matter world, that the particles of the ship do not change their velocity. If the speed of the particles is changed, in particular, slowed down, if it varies, well, then there's a change. When you come back into the physical world, you will have slipped millions, maybe even billions of years in time. It's that sensitive. And he was starting to explain that a little bit, and Billy was getting just a little lost, and he was curious how fast they were going at the moment. And Patah showed him some dials or something there on the equipment and how they were working, and Billy was able to figure out the speed that they were going at and relate it to kind of like I've translated it to miles per hour. It came out to 280,000 kilometers per hour was the speed at the moment that the ship was traveling in free space. So they've made the jump to the Pleiades. And Billy's getting a little excited, and somehow Semyasi senses in his thoughts that he would like to take a picture of all this. And she just says, yes, you can take a picture if you'd like to. I'll have one of the droids get your camera equipment out of the ship. He apparently had left it there. And Billy didn't even notice that she picked that out of his thoughts. He hadn't even asked the question. So Semyasi already had sent a droid of some type to get the camera equipment, and it was back real quickly, and Billy had his camera equipment. And about that time, Patah mentioned to him, he says, well, we're going to make another jump in about 9 seconds to the area that you call the Orion Nebula, and we will be approximately 1,800 light years from Earth. Well, Billy gets his camera ready because he wants to try to record on film what happens and what you actually see in space when they make this jump to hyperspace. But it's way too fast, and the light's not strong enough, and his pictures never came out in this, because apparently all you see is everything looks the same. And then there's a very kind of a momentary blur where all reality right around you seems to blur just for a part second, and then it's over. And that's all they really, you don't experience anything. Well, they apparently had several things they needed to do to that day. They made two or three different jumps to different areas. And during the course of time, they continued to explain to Billy a little bit technically more about how the ship was operating. Each time they made a jump, Billy was becoming more sensitive. He was trying very hard to pick up on this feeling that he was getting when they made the jump, this small microsecond there where he's in touch a little bit with eternity. And he's getting more and more intrigued by it, and in his mind, he's, you know, trying to figure out how it works. And Patah senses that he has a lot of interest in this and explains to him that, well, in the normal hyperspace jump, that it's no problem for them to paralyze time. That actually when you watch your watch, no time really transpires. It's just almost instantaneous. But because that they are actually leaving the coarse material world that we live in, the matter world, and that the ship actually is entering the fine matter world. It's no longer physical. It's just fine matter like thought then. Since it is actually converted to that, it does exist in a different state there for a very brief time. And he explains to Billy that they can stay on purpose in the fine matter world for a period of time if they're very careful about how they control the speed of their particles when they are in the fine matter world. And again, he explained to them, if they don't control the speed just exactly right, if they slow down a little too much or drop the speed, that they would find themselves in endless, timeless loss. They would never find their way back home. They would be, apparently, they would get so far out of time, wherever they would be, that it would be impossible for them to even find their way back. So they had to be very careful, but he says they could control, they had learned to control it where they could control the speed, the velocity of the particles just a little bit, so they could actually stay in the fine matter world for 7 minutes. And he says, here's what would happen. He says, if you are interested in that, we can do that, that we're going to be making a jump to what they call the barrier. There is a barrier built, a man-made barrier built by the Timmers, Ascot people, at a certain place in the universe that connects the two universes together. And they're going to be going to that today. And that apparently, on that particular jump, he says, if you would like, we've done it many times, and we can cause the ship then to stay in the fine matter world for 7 minutes. And we can do this by controlling the velocity of the particles very, very little. And he remarks that in the fine matter world, there actually is time. Not like we have time here, but it's on a whole different scale. That just one little millionth of a second is equal to millions of years in the physical world. So to be outside in the fine matter world and to change the velocity just for a part second, they would slip just a little bit. They would remain in the fine matter world for 7 minutes then because of that very slight dip in velocity just for a part second. They would stay there for 7 minutes, and 35 minutes would actually go by in the known physical world. Now let me explain that one more time. In the normal world, here's how it would work. Let's say there are two of us, and we synchronize our watches, and we're on planet A, which is Earth, and let's say we're going to go to planet B, which is Era in the Pleiades. And we're in our ship, so we synchronize our watches. Okay, the ship takes off, and we start our watches here, we're watching our watch, and we're getting ready to make this jump over into the Pleiades. And normally when this is done, they paralyze time and space so that there is no time loss at all. But on this particular occasion, they're going to, on purpose, control the velocity of the particles in hyperspace so that they stay in hyperspace for 7 minutes, and there will be 35 minutes elapse on our watches. So here's what happens. The experiment starts. The ship then initiates the hyperspace, the jump into hyperspace, and we hit the button on our watches. Time is running now, okay? The ship goes into hyperspace, creates the time dilation. The programming is set in motion then for the ship is no longer solid. It is in the fine matter energy world. It is now in an energy state. And we have pre-programmed those particles while we were in the physical state so that once we enter into this fine matter, there is a very, very slight retarding of the speed of the particles just for a part second. And I don't know how long that is. They said it's just a millionth part second. So it's a very fast thing because you can't retard the speed very long and we slip way off into time and we'll be totally lost. So the ship does that. The particles are programmed. We go into the fine matter world. We retard the speed just for that part second. We now, in the fine matter world, 7 minutes, we will actually experience being in fine matter, in a non-physical form. 7 minutes will go by while we're in the fine matter world, and we will have awareness of that, that your spirit will be aware that it's in the fine matter world for 7 minutes. At the end of that 7 minutes, we, the ship and everybody in it then, is converted back into the physical world. Only 7 minutes has gone by on our watches for those of us who are on the spirit side. We were there for 7 minutes. But we look at our watch, on the people on the planet, 35 minutes went by. That equates to 1 second in the timeless is equal to 5 seconds in the physical world. That's the general ratio. So 35 minutes went by, but we only lived 7 minutes. So in effect, we 28 minutes, we're now younger. The people in the material world live for 35 minutes, but we were gone during that 35 minutes, and we only lived for 7 minutes. So there might even be the beginning of a technology or somewhere where we could do with the cells of our body somehow, where the process could actually be reversed, where we could run all of our cells through the fine matter world or something and retard the life span. I don't know. But that's how they do it. And they had learned technically to get to that particular point where they could control the speed of the particles in the fine matter world. Well, Billy says his mind was boggled and he couldn't begin to understand how all that is possible. But if they were willing to retard and do this and allow him 7 minutes in eternity, he was very excited. He says, well, how would it be possible? Is everybody here going to experience that? And he says, no. All of us on the ship will feel it. Everybody on board the Great Spacer will sense that they are in the fine matter world. And Semyasi remarks, one of the drawbacks here, Billy, is that because we're in the fine matter state, it's not possible for our physical minds at that point to record your thoughts while you're in the fine matter state, which is what they normally did. So when Billy got home, they could play all of it back. They have devices that record all of your thinking, so when Billy would get home, he could play it all back and then write it down so we could read. He was on board the Great Spacer, and he just was getting ready to experience eternity. And where Patad explained to him that they had the ability to cause the Great Spacer, when it's in timelessness, when it's in that null time, fine matter world, they had the ability to retard the velocity of the particles just minutely enough to allow the ship to spend 7 minutes in the fine matter world. And again, now the universe is comprised of coarse matter, which is all the solid matter, and it's also comprised of fine matter, which is the energy, non-solid parts of the universe. So the ship is going to enter this fine matter world, which is sometimes described as a hyperspace mode, a null time, whatever you care to call it. But it's in this non-physical state that they are able to make these long jumps. And Patas just explained to Billy how it's possible that they can control the duration that they are in the fine matter world so he can experience eternity himself. Apparently this is something that most of the people on the Pleiades at one time or another have done, and it gives them the ability to actually experience a little bit of what creation, the creational energy, is really like. So Billy's got a little bit of time here alone with Semyasi before that they're going to do that. And she's explaining to him how they have these apparatus which allow them to actually record his thinking while he's in the fine matter world, because they wouldn't be able to do it normally. Billy, out of the clear blue, says, Semyasi, while we're waiting, could you write something for me for the people back home? And she says, what do you mean write? What's that for? And he says, you know, well, I'm always having a lot of contacts. I'm always talking about you and explaining things to people. But they don't feel very close to you at all, because they never get to see you or whatever. And it'd be nice for you to do something kind of personal so they'd feel a little closer to you. And if you were to write something, just a short message, hello, or draw a picture, or most anything, that'd make them feel real good, kind of, you know, closer, more of a friendship thing. And she says, I understand, but... because I have no idea what to write. And he says, well, maybe you could write something like in your own language, and that would be kind of interesting. He says, by the way, what does your alphabet look like? So she draws the alphabet. She begins to write in the symbols that they use, and he recognizes right away that, well, many of those characters that you're drawing, symbols and so forth, look very similar to some of the old writings and things that exist on Earth. How is that possible? And she explains that, well, you know, it was only about 11,000 years ago that our ancestors still lived there in the great continent of Atlantis, where they used the same language. And at the time of the Great Destruction, when they blew up Atlantis and Mu, there were still many of our ancestors living on the planet that understood this language. For instance, the Sumerians in the old India area. And that language has just kind of filtered its way down Many of the three Indian tribes that still existed, remember there were three races of humans that were pulled together that existed after that, they were familiar with some of these symbols and some of these writings. So some of it is filtered down, some of the words and so forth are similar. So the Pleiadians themselves today still use the ancient Lyrian language, and some of it has worked its way into our society, and some of the words, like the word Salome, is not so much different than the word Shalom. Salome in their language is spelled S-A-A-L-O-M-E. It means peace in wisdom. So there are many characters, words, and so forth from their old language which have found their way into our earthly cultures of different types. So Semyasi writes a little message out for Billy to take home. And Billy goes through her alphabet and jots down all the characters of their alphabet, and then makes some notes about the pronunciation and so forth. So we have the Pleiadian alphabet. As a matter of fact, I will have, I'm just deciding now as I speak, I'll put that in the little diagram book that I'm going to draw for you. So there'll be a sheet in there showing the Pleiadian alphabet, and it'll also show the symbols of the Pleiadian world and so forth, and a few of their words and how they speak and so forth. So I'll put that in there for you. About this time, as Billy's waiting, he says, well, you know, I guess it's now's as good a time as any, since I have a little time here. I'm ready to meet this this god, this Pleiadian god that was listening into my thoughts earlier. And the Semyasi begins to chuckle a little bit, and he says, well, what's so funny? And she says, well, you've already met him. That was my father, Ptah. Well, Billy suddenly becomes really embarrassed in his thoughts, and he's kind of stumbling over himself. Oh, my, what a fool I've been. All this time I thought that the great God may be a big pretentious so-and-so, and your father's so nice, and he's so pleasant, and you treat him just like anyone else. And she said, yes, even on our world, unlike yours, where people are all treated the same. Men and women are treated the same, and even those people who have become Ishwishes, kings of wisdoms, or gods to your people, she says, even these people, we still revere them on a very personal, we think of them on a very personal basis, that they're no better or less than the rest of us. They just benefit from greater lifetimes. And again, a reminder here that your spirit accumulates wisdom from lifetime to lifetime. And after a period of time, you gain in this wisdom. That's what spiritual growth is. So an Ishwish is the person who's lived more lifetimes, who through those many lifetimes and through the physical senses has gathered information, experiences, carried that wisdom forward in their spirit, and slowly, 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 after numerous lifetimes, has gained the knowledge and experience of the physical world. At a certain point, these people have all the knowledges of nature and understand the elemental world and what's going on, and then they become a king of wisdom. A king of wisdom, again, is an Ishwish, which means God or King of Wisdom. And this is a person who has gained the knowledge and is still in the physical realm. He's still a physical person. Looks just like anyone else, but his mind is so spiritually developed that he has these knowledges. So that's what Ptah is. There apparently are many Ishwishes in the Pleiadian world, but they still seem to be very casual. There's no worshiping involved and so forth. So Billy was rather taken back this, but he was glad to see that it turned out that the Pleiadian god was still just a good guy you could sit down and have a conversation with. Well, it was time to get on with the jump. Billy's about to experience eternity, so he's getting a little excited, and he says, well, how's this going to work? How is it possible that myself and you and everybody else in this ship are going to go into the fine matter world, and how am I going to be able to experience this and remember it later on? She says, well, here's how we'll do it. We have a device, and she takes him into a special area, and she says, you'll sit in this chair, and he says, kind of an unusual-looking chair, and he sits down in this seat, and she says, we have a device that will record your thoughts, that we can program this thing, so it will sense your thoughts while you're in the fine matter world, and we'll be able then to recall them later on. I have no idea how this works. It's a helmet of some sort that's lowered down over Billy's head. Billy notes that it doesn't touch the head. It was just lowered down over it. And it's a physical thing. It's a device of some type that's going to record the thoughts that you're thinking. Well, the unusual part is if the ship is going into this fine matter world and it's a physical object, I really have no idea how it's capable then of recording thoughts, because it also would no longer be physical and non-operative, I would think. So they have some pretty advanced technology then, if they're able to do that, that somehow even the particles of the computers and this equipment can be programmed so they can be operable when they're in the fine matter world to record his thoughts, because that's exactly what's going to happen. Well, we're getting close to the time for the jump to come, and Billy is sitting in the seat, and the device is lowered down over his head, and he's preparing his thoughts and trying to get ready for what's going to happen next. So he's sitting there, and he notices it's just about getting ready to happen, and he sees Semyonov's backing up, and suddenly he looks up and sees that the stars are beginning to change again. That here comes the the jump just like it happened before, and he sees everybody kind of freeze and go into this milky thing, and there's a kind of a little streaking action where all the stars are slightly blurred, and then suddenly all this goes black. There's no more stars, there's nothing, there's no coloring at all. He's just they're in the fine matter world now, and it's just this plain, dark, black area. And at the moment, there's no sensations whatever. Suddenly the darkness gives way to kind of a golden color. All around him becomes gold and then slowly moves off into kind of a silver color. Everything is changing and it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. The light becomes kind of a glistening, like a sparkling sort of thing, and gets super bright. And Billy notes that it's brighter than looking at a sun, but yet it doesn't hurt your eyes. Well, of course it wouldn't. At this point, you don't have any eyes. You're in a non-physical existence. The ship has just made its jump into hyperspace. There's a time dilation, it's called. All of your particles, all of the physical existence, then, are now in a fine matter state. They're only existing as energy. Matter has been converted to energy. And it is now programmed for 7 minutes to be in this timeless situation. Well, in Billy's notes, there's about 5 pages here describing his thoughts of all the things that went through his mind while he's in this 7 minutes of eternity. So, not having it experienced myself, I can't tell you exactly what it's like. He said words even escaped him also, but I'll try to do the best I can explaining what the 7 minutes were like in this eternity. After he's immediately overcome with kind of the sensation of the light, he's still aware of himself. He's still aware of his personality, his own identity, and he's still thinking like in his normal mind. He has that awareness. But one of the first things that really happens is his feeling is changing. And he starts using a word like magnificent, magnificent. Man, oh man, this eternity, it's magnificent. What a feeling. And he's going on and on here a little bit about how his feelings are starting to change. There's this wonderful feeling of comfort, of love overcoming him. Gone and dissipating are any feelings and stress, the remembrances, the thoughts of the physical life. Several times throughout this, he will start to remember what it was like in the physical life. Oh, man, he says, oh, the physical life, so much pain and strife, and it's hard work and difficulties of putting up with the material physical world. How different this is. How wonderful this is over here in the fine matter world. Because what's happening? We go through life perceiving everything with our physical senses, don't we? Sight, feel, touch, smell, hearing, so forth. And we perceive everything with those senses, and then we make decisions and judgments and values and everything based off of our physical thing. But we're not used to perceiving things with our spiritual self. And this is what's beginning to happen to Billy. When he first gets into this fine matter world, he's not used to experiencing things with the non-physical, so there's still the feeling of self. And then slowly, after a little bit of time here, he begins to start sensing things around him with his spirit. He's disconnected now from his physical senses. Sight, feel, touch, and smell, they're gone. So you no longer perceive information with those senses. You begin to perceive the information with your spiritual self. Very much like you would do in a very deep, deep meditation. But here, there are no physical senses, so it's like instantly into the deepest form of meditation that you could probably get. And a few really wonderful things start to happen. First of all, he notices, he begins to feel his spirit. He can understand his spiritual self without the bearing the weight of any physical existence. This is probably something like what happens to us now when we slip off, when we die, and we leave the physical body. Suddenly there's this dissipation of the physical awareness. And he's becoming aware of his spiritual self. And he's sensing his surroundings. And he starts to feel the presence of other beings. He feels the presence just mile in. He almost hears someone calling out to him, but he can't quite grasp it. But he knows that there are other energies around him. He's probably experiencing the other people that are on the ship that are going through the same thing. So this feeling continues to grow into him. And now, after a minute or so, all the feelings of the physical are left behind. And he's left in there in this glistening light, becoming aware of the fact that he's slowly becoming in touch with eternity. And he starts to see this clearer and clearer, what's happening here. He's getting in touch and he's sensing the creational energy, and here we're using creational energy and eternity to mean the same thing. He's becoming aware of this energy. Normally we're not aware of this. We're so busy perceiving everything with our physical senses that we don't really have any living physical proof that there is a God force or creational energy, whatever you want to call it, really out there. But now Billy is slowly becoming aware that it does exist, and here it is. His feelings slowly start growing into the fact that he realizes that he's no longer alone. He is not just one individual. In our physical world, we're like that. We think of all of ourself first, me, I, because we're always aware just of self, and we go out and perceive other people and other things with our senses. Here's something new is happening. Here he's in a spiritual form, and he's sensing the other spirit forms around him, and suddenly he's feeling the connection to other spirit forms. He's beginning to feel like that connection between all spirit forms, where everybody's connected together, sharing. There's a connection between all the people, and there's something greater even in here. There's even something better than just the connection to the other spirit forms. They are all, and he also, is connected to the creational energy. And for the first time, he's beginning to feel very strongly that it is really there. There's this overwhelming feeling of love and comp and warmth and just generally feeling good. There are no more feelings brought on from the physical world of depression, of anger, of anything. Any tensions are left behind from the physical world, and you're left alone in this blissful state where the creational energy that's out there, which is perfection itself, is beginning to move in and make its impression on his spirit, and he and everyone on the ship is feeling it. Imagine, if you can, the ability to shut off your physical existence and just for a moment to feel the complete love and perfection of the spiritual energy of the universe. Billy's starting to move into this. He suddenly becomes aware that death is no big deal at all, that it is no great terror or horror. It's simply a conversion from the material form into the fine matter form. And actually, it's a really wonderful, blissful state. That over here in this fine matter world, there is existence. And most importantly, there is awareness and there is connection with other spirits and the creational energy of the universe. So he's becoming more and more fulfilled with this. As he's doing this, the things that he's learned about spirituality, about adding things to your spirit and this accumulative wisdom, become more and more clear to him, because he can begin to feel other spirits all of different levels. He can sense people, their spirits, that they are at different levels of evolution. And he can feel clearly now that everyone in here, there are millions of spirits, uncountable spirits, all connected to creation, and that everyone has their own path. Everyone's on their own level of evolution. You see, again, the reason for the physical life is to gather information with your senses. You create logic, you have experiences, and when you've had experience and it becomes part of yourself physically, the wisdom from that experience is passed on to your spirit. That information moves on from lifetime to lifetime. And as your spirit gathers in wisdom, that's what spiritual evolution is. So everyone is slightly at a different spot. We're all learning different things and experiencing things at different times. So it's a little different from all of us. We're all on our own paths of discovery and going different places. So The important thing is that Billy is sensing this very clearly. He can feel other spirits and sense that they're all different, that they're all experiencing different things. They have different feelings about them, but they're all connected to creation, and they all share that in common. What a wonderful thing it would be on our world, in our physical world, if we learn to calm down and use our spirit when we meet someone to perceive them as a spiritual being instead of just what we experience with our physical. Normally, let's say a plant, for instance. Normally, you just go drive by a bush and you don't think anything of it because it's just something to walk by. Now, maybe if you're really into flowers, you might stop and notice what a pretty flower it is or what kind it is or how it was grown or where it's grown. But let's think just for a second that suddenly, even with a flower, because it's part of creation also, it's just at a different level than us. Let's just for a second imagine that we could look at a flower, and anything in nature for that matter, and look at it as a spiritual energy, a spiritual being of its own. And just for a second perceive it that it also is just like us, a spiritual form moving through an evolution, and that it also is connected to creation. It's not just a material thing. Something really wonderful happens when you perceive anything in creation as a spiritual being on its own and look at its wonderful self that it's doing, that it's creating its own life and it's creating its own petals. It's having its own experience. It's not mad at you. It's not challenging you. It's not threatening you. These are things that we do with our physical senses. We learn in our difficult society to be prejudiced and hate and anger and these things, but all these things dissipate for the spiritual person. The person who can perceive anything in life as a spiritual entity, as a spiritual form first, hate, anger, and these things just vanish. They don't even ever come up. So Billy's in this fine matter world, experiencing the love of all of these spirits, and he's feeling more and more the connection to creation itself. And as the minutes go by, that feeling gets stronger and stronger, and he becomes clearer and more aware that the creation itself is the true perfection. What is happening here? Well, what really happened is that creation itself is a collection, it is an idea. I think you could describe the creation best as the creation is a spiritual energy that embodies the idea of perfect love, of perfect coming together of all the senses of all forms of creation. It is the creation that had the idea for the spiritual energy to begin the universe. And all these things that we know of from all the solid matter from different creatures, planets, and so forth are all forms, spirit forms, created by the original idea of creation. So creation is a collection, then, of all forms of energy that have evolved up to their own perfection. Billy can start to sense in the fine matter world that there are entities who have gone beyond the physical, no longer need the material senses. Some of them have gone into what we think of as they've moved together and become collective consciousnesses together, where spirits then begin to come together in small groups of like sevens, and then they move on and come into larger groups. Then they totally lose awareness of the physical altogether. They are now contributing to the general welfare of the universe by creating thoughts and energy forms and so forth that help the universe itself actually work. Eventually, the human form will evolve into being part of the creational energy itself and goes on as the universe is going through its cycles to help with the actual creation of the next one. So the creational energy, and this is where the concept of we are all gods who are sharing in God comes from, that it is true that we are all part of the creational energy and that the creational spirit itself is just other energy forms before us who have, you might say, graduated through all these levels of accumulating wisdom. They've evolved to the point where they have, through wisdom, earned the right to be part of the creational force of the universe. And that's what we are all doing. We're just very young on the scale. So Billy gets more and more excited, and he is affirming and confirming all the things that he's been learning over the years about spirit, and it becomes very, very clear to him what life is really all about. Imagine having experiencing like that. So in a Pleiadian world, most all of them have been able to experience that for themselves. It's not to the point where you just have to like stumble around and try to figure out what life is all about. Here you've had a full dose of it. Here you have clear understanding that life is physical and non-physical, that the universe is solid and its energy, coarse matter and fine matter. Here is proof that there is a creational force. Here is proof that there's a creational force that we are all connected to, that we are all sharing in, and we are all growing on our own paths. And here's proof that we are a spiritual being that is moving through a series of material lives to grow on our own. So what a wonderful experience he had. He got deeper and deeper into this where he was just at a loss for words. He's just rambling on about magnificent, wonderful feeling, the love of it all. And finally, it's getting to the point where he's starting to sense the creational energy itself more and more. He is so overcome with the loving, caring feeling that he's getting from it. He is just lost. He's so caught up in this. Well, unfortunately, it's about right here that he suddenly senses that it's over, that he's pulling back into the physical. The ship has re-entered out of the timelessness, out of the fine matter world, and is coming back into the physical, and he doesn't want to. He's trying to stay there. He's fighting it very hard, and he's saying, no, I don't want to come back. I don't want to go back into the material world. It's wonderful here. Oh, surely the Earth man must know how wonderful this is on this side. Everyone must learn, you know, what it's like to be a spiritual self, and how could anyone ever, you know, think a mean thought, and, you know, if they know about the spiritual side. And he's going on and on like this, and suddenly he feels Sannyasi is shaking him. And he kind of snaps to, and she's grinning, and she can tell what's going through his mind. And he just does not want to leave this state of mind and come back into the physical. And she comments to him, well, I understand, I know, we've all experienced the same thing, and this is your first time. And he's just babbling. He's going on and on about how wonderful it is. And she helps him out of the chair, and I can almost imagine what state you might be in at that point, having had an experience like that. You can even begin to see now a little bit why Billy's the way that he is. There are a lot of stories about Billy being a hermit and keeping to himself and not wanting to really see other people and talk about his life much anymore. And maybe now you can start to understand why. Billy is a very a unique person, both by his experiences and his thoughts, in that the things that he's experienced in his life make him quite different than the rest of us. It's very difficult to have lived and experienced and gained the knowledges that he has and come back into our 9-to-5 world of credit cards, freeways, cars, jobs, and things like that. So Billy keeps himself in an environment that's conducive to his thoughts. He's trying very hard to hang on to the feeling and the wonderment of all the things that he's experienced and keeps himself in an environment like that. This is the reason that he and the people around him, which are learning from him, they try to protect their environment. They're not being cold or rude to other people. On the one hand, they're trying to protect their lifestyle so that they can also learn and gain experience from this and try to interface with the real world that's always knocking at their door. And that's not a real easy task to do. Okay, well, Billy's out of this, and Sannyasi says, well, you know, we have a few other things to do, and he says, now what's going on? And he's just kind of shaken up. And Patah comes over to talk to him, and they get into a conversation, and Billy's commenting on the great experience that he's just had because, you know, being a physical person, a normal human like the rest of us, he keeps forgetting all the time how telepathic they are, and they already know everything he's just experienced. They probably, you know, tried to listen in or whatever they could afterwards, or if that was possible, to what happened to him. But Patah is already sensing in Billy's mind the experience that he had, and he's just kind of nodding his head, you know, and yes, yes, I understand. And Billy's going on and on about how wonderful it was, how great it was, oh, blah, 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 you know. And they have to slow him down and calm him down a little bit. And Patah calms him down, and they sit down, and they have a lovely conversation for about, you know, half an hour or so, which is in his notes. And it's basically all centered around reminding Billy the importance of his mission, how special he is. And Patah's explaining to him how important it is that he understands that even though they seem to heap praise on him from time to time about how capable he is, they're trying to make him really understand and become aware of how special he is. That he was born into a physical family of a normal farmer's family in Switzerland, but he had a very special lifetime ahead of him, that he is the prophet of our times. He's not greater or better than any of the rest of us. A prophet is a person who helps us, who's inspiring, who's a visionary, who leads us down a path of self-discovery by nature of the things that they can tell us. And this is what Billy is. Billy was the chosen one to have all these experiences with the Pleiadians and experience things because he's capable of it, because of the age of his spirit. And so he passes it on to us. So that's what he is as a prophet. And Ptah is making this clear to him that, you know, he's not not to think of this as a big-headed thing. It's just, it is his job, it's his mission, it's his role, and to look at it and take it seriously. So they have a lengthy conversation about that. And somewhere in here, Ptah motions to him and says, you'll notice out here in space now where we're at. And Billy looks up and it's all very black, and there he doesn't see anything except one little star off there. And Ptah says, well, we're coming to a very special area now in space, and that little star over there called Galtos, I think was the name of it, he says that's the farthest, most remote sun in the universe. It's at a very special place. And Billy says, oh, the edge of the universe. And Ptah says, no, as we've told you before, there is no edge to the universe. The universe doesn't have an edge, but this is a very remote area. And the reason we're here is that this is where the barrier between universes is. And we are going to go into another universe called the Tao universe. And Billy's thoughts kind of go snap, and he says, Tao universe, that's where my old friend Aska was from. And he Semyasi's sitting there, and he says, Semyasi, this Tao universe, Aska, that's what the surprise must be all about. I'm going to see Aska again, isn't it? And she smiles, and Billy's getting even more excited because he never dreamed that he would see Ascot again. Ascot was his teacher and mentor from age 16 to about age 24. And at the age of 16, he met this woman. We're going to hear a lot more about her in the next few tapes, but just to give you a little rough background, she is from a very highly evolved race of people called Timmers, and they live in the Tao universe. She came into our universe, met Billy, and became his teacher when he was young. Billy was only 16 when he first became exposed to her. When he first physically met her, he was quite overcome by her and very impressionable, of course, by a very highly evolved, nice-looking woman, and just like any of us would be. But he never expected to see her again, and he has great feelings for her. So he was also getting very excited that he was about to meet Ascot again. So Semyasi explains that they're coming to the barrier, and he looks up and he can see it. And it's this very large area. And he's just kind of going, wow, one thing after another. And look at this. And there's this huge man-made thing out here. It's like a big tunnel that is built that they're going to go through. And he says, well, do we have to make like a jump or something to do this? And she says, no. We're going to go right through this in physical form. It's about 1 million kilometers long, and I forget how wide it was, but it was very large. And they go right through it, almost before she can even finish explaining what it was all about. When they get through it, they're again in black space, and the Ptah mentions, we are now in the Tao universe. Well, Billy looks up, and he sees a little ship floating out in space. And he says, that must be the ship of Ascot. And she says, you're right, we're going to meet up with Ascot. Well, Billy's little heart is pounding again. He's all excited. What a day he's having. So he's excited again, and he's up on his feet. And Semyasi says, well, come on, we're going to go have our meeting with Ascot now. Let's go over to her ship. And she takes Billy by the hand, and they walk over to an area, and there's like a hole in the floor. And she tells Billy, just go ahead and step off into that space, and it's a lift, and it'll lower you down to where the ship is parked. And Billy's a little apprehensive because, you know, who wants to step into a hole and just fall down into free space? But she assures him that it'll be okay. He goes ahead and he steps off into the space there, and he doesn't fall. He just slowly starts being let down. He looks up, and Semyasi is right behind him, and it just takes a few seconds, and they go thousands of meters, and suddenly they're standing right down next to where the beam ship was parked way down below. Well, they get into Semyasi's ship again, and they pull out from the great spacer, and it's just a short distance over to where Ascot's ship is parked. Ascot's ship is much smaller than the spacer, And it just has room in it for one beam ship to park. They pull right into Ascot's ship and park in, I guess you call it a hangar or something like that, in the ship. And Billy's getting quite excited just at the prospect of meeting Ascot. My, what a bunch of great experiences he's having all in one day here. He's going to have emotional overloading here. So he gets out of the beam ship, and they're walking with Semyase, and he notices that everything's kind of metal-looking, the hallways, and it's kind of coal-looking. And they go down the hallway, and this wall kind of opens up, and they go into this very nice-looking, comfortable room with chairs and very comfortable furniture. And he looks across the room, and there's Ascot. Now, Ascot's a tall, blonde, very nice-looking woman. There's a picture of her over at Billy's house. She's a very beautiful, nice-looking woman. And he's just kind of overcome. He hasn't seen her in ages, and he was very impressed by her when he was young, when he had these meetings when he was 16. And it's been a long time now since he's seen her. I think he stopped seeing her in 64, I think it was, something where in there. And so we're up to like 75. So it's been 11 years since he's seen her. And he never really expected to see her again. One thing I need to tell you about Ascot, her race, the Timbers, are far older even than the Pleiadians are. And they have total faculty of the mind. And by that I mean as they have recall of any thought or word that they've spoken throughout their life. An incredible concept, right? But they're using a very large percentage of their brain. Later on we'll find out that Ascot was even able to recall to Billy word for word and thought by thought almost all of their experiences and help him go over his notes from his encounters with her years later. Well, one of the special things about Ascot also is the fact that they have an interesting way of saying hello. We kind of shake hands and, hi, how are you, and talk for a few minutes to establish an atmosphere between each other when we meet each other. Well, with Ascot it's slightly different. When Billy first met Ascot the first time, the physical contact years ago, he remarked that she has the ability, when they say hello, she takes and kind of pushes telepathically all of her feelings and love and concern for another human right into you. And Billy says every cell in your body tingles with the sensation and the feeling that she pushes into you. And he's never forgotten that, and it just happens to him again. She just rushes him mentally with her wonderful feelings of love that she has for all of humanity, and especially him. And his heart's just pounding 90 miles an hour. He can't even talk. He's trying to speak, and he's just like stuck. You know, nothing comes out of his mouth, and he's just stuck right there on the floor. So Ascot walks over, sensing this, that Billy's a little overcome. He's just about to tears. And she takes him by the hand and pulls him close and gives him a really nice hug and a little kiss. And he's just kind of beside himself like a little puppy, I guess. And he says, a kiss, a kiss. And she says, well, of course, you know, it's people on Earth aren't the only ones that kiss. We can do that, too. And he says, Ascot, Ascot, I never thought I would see you again. And she said, well, I wasn't sure that we ever would see you again when last I left you. This meeting was not projected. I didn't really expect to, so there was no way I could let you know that it was really going to happen in the future. And they're talking for a few minutes, and he's calming down, and he says, well, what is the purpose? Why are you here? How come we're meeting? And she says, well, it's twofold. Mostly I just wanted to see you, but we do have another mission. And I think Semyase had explained a little bit about Billy to it before, that Ascot explained that her people, the Timbers, who live in the Tao universe, some years back, about 9 years previously, they were experimenting with kind of a time projectile capsule that they could time project from their universe into ours. It doesn't fly. They somehow just cause it to time displace, and it would come from their universe and just appear right in onto Earth. Well, they had sent one of these projectiles as a test, and it had gotten lost. There had been a miscalculation somehow in the time projection, and the Earth was not where it was supposed to, where they thought it was going to be when the capsule hit the planet, and so it got lost. And apparently the capsule was a little late, and the Earth had already rotated and moved, and they couldn't find it. It took, I think, Semyase about 3 years, she said, to find the capsule, and it was in India somewhere. And there was even an accompanying story and letter that Billy had heard from earlier. He says, oh, I've heard something about that. And he turns to Semyase and says, I received a letter from a couple of women who say they came across an extraterrestrial woman digging something out of the sand in India and said her name was Semyasi. And I thought, well, that couldn't be. And then Semyasi confirmed, yep, that was me. I did have those experiences. That's one of the reasons we're here, is to return the time capsule. We could have done it in other ways, but we wanted to tie this in also with your reunion with Askin. So they came to retrieve the capsule, and Billy's just so excited, you know. And Askin says, excuse me just a moment, and I'd like you to meet Nira. And Nira, and it's spelled N-E-R-A, she's a dark brunette-looking woman, very nice-looking woman, and I'd like you to meet Nira. And Semyasi says, Askin, is this your ship? And she says, no, this is not my ship. I'm acting here as the first commander. Excuse me, the captain of this ship is named Scholars. And unfortunately, you won't be able to meet him, though. He was off doing something else. But she introduced Billy and Semyasi to Nira as her deputy, second in command here. And she says, Billy, if you'll speak with Nira just a few moments, and I need to go, she goes with Semyasi to get the time projectile out of the beam ship. So Billy's left with Nira to talk, and he takes one look at Nira, and he immediately has these swelled up feelings in him again of, you know, what a nice looking woman, how pretty she was. And Nira kind of giggles because she's feeling what Billy's thinking, and Billy, again, being an Earthman, forgets how telepathic they are, and he's a little embarrassed. But she calms him down and explains, well, it's very kind of you for an Earth person, that I've been on Earth many times, and I'm not used to Earth men having those kinds of feelings of sincerity about women. A little slam towards us there. And Billy says, really, you've been on Earth? And she says, yes, several times with Askin in the past, and sometime in the future we will probably return again. And he says, when is that? And he says, well, no time soon. It'll be long after you've passed away in your physical life. We may return again there in the future sometime. They also, like the Pleiadians, enjoy a much longer lifespan than we do. Well, Nira, they have a little chat about life on Earth and some of her experiences, and she explains to Billy, because of his question about why always women, that she says, well, the Pleiadians and their people had discovered a long time ago that on Earth it was much better to use women for contacts because we're much more open to it. That when they have a contact with a man, that the man always seemed to feel a little threatened or whatever, and the contacts don't go as easily, that they have found that that the Earth men get along much better with Earth women. And Billy comments, yeah, I know what you mean. I don't get along with other guys as well as I get along with other women. So, but I'm sure that has something to do there probably with the sexual attraction, too. Semyasi and Askin are back with the time projectile. Billy asks if he can take a picture. He wants to get a picture of all three of them. And they decide they'll consent to that because Askin and Nira won't be on Earth anymore, and they don't mind. And they comment that, well, Semyasi can join us in the picture, but this must be for only your own private use, and you can't pass it around because Semyasi still has work to do on Earth and doesn't want her picture around, anybody to know what she looks like. So Billy agrees, and he takes the picture of all three of them. I have not seen that picture. Unfortunately, though, it probably is part of the collection that got lost. Billy shot several rolls of film on this trip and only got about one of them back. The rest are disappeared somewhere in the mail or probably in private collections and in government drawers and so forth. But anyway, he snaps the picture of Semyasi, Askin, and Nira, and then he also takes a couple extra pictures of just Askin and Nira, which we do have. They're a little blurry, and they're slightly greenish-gray, like most all of his pictures inside of ships. And his camera's jammed just a little short of F-16, so his pictures never come out remarkably clear when he's close. So they're just a little bit off. So the reunion is kind of solidified there with Askin, and it's time now for them to leave. And Semyasi remarks that, well, we still have some other things to do, and it's time for them to say goodbye. They have some other experiences for Billy to enjoy before they take him back to Earth. So Semyasi and Billy leave the ship of Askin and head back towards the Great Spacer. On the way, Billy's asking about this concept of parallel worlds. And Semyasi explains that, yes, there is a parallel universe. That all the planets, suns, and everything, all the physical matter of the the universe actually has a parallel form, that each planet has an exact parallel of itself, that there is a parallel to the planet Earth, where you would see the same people, buildings, and cities, and so forth. The only difference is there's a slight difference in time. And Billy comments, you know, gee, you'd like to take a picture of that. She says, well, it really wouldn't reveal very much because it looks exactly the same as the present world really does. She says it would be okay, but you really couldn't expect to get very much. They get back over to the Great Spacer and they park the ship again in pretty much the same place that they did before. And once again, they take the little floating craft, whatever you want to call it, this little floating platform, and they go back up to the top of the spacer where Ptah is. Ptah immediately senses how excited Billy is from all these experiences he's just had and invites him to sit down and talk with him a little bit. He explains to him that what's going to happen next is they're going to go back through the barrier, back over into their own universe. And so Billy's looking up in the space, and he can see the big barrier up in front of him there. And Ptah remarks that they're going to go back through the barrier when they get to the other end, that they're going to have some time. They have to wait when they get through the barrier on the other side because they have to close the barrier. And when they close the barrier, he says it's automated. The ship is automatically programmed to do that, but it takes about 50 minutes for the actual closing of the barrier. Apparently this barrier, he also explained, was that there are only certain locations that it would be possible to build this barrier. And he didn't specify where those may be. Of course, we wouldn't have any idea what he was relating to anyway. So they do get through the barrier and they stop. It takes a very short time to get through it. And they pull through. And Ptah mentions that they're going to be waiting now. If Billy has any questions, that he could be a good time to ask. And Billy says, sure, I got lots of questions. Semyasa remarks, when is there a time when he doesn't have questions? So one of the first things that Billy wanted to kind of talk about was, he says, repeatedly throughout the contacts and even through his other contacts with other races, there's always been the subject all the time of religions, and he understands to some degree why religions can be difficult for people when they become cult followers, so forth, of certain belief things, and it forces them not to be taking responsibility for themselves. But he also realizes that religion is also like a learning step that people can go through. So he's interested in Ptah's comments about religion. One of the main things that he did comment on says, yes, religions are a learning step, and it is something that everybody has to go through. One of the things they were concerned about, though, is that on Earth, unlike on other planets that go through belief structures and so forth, it had gone so far where religions had become so powerful, they had not seen this happen anyplace else in the universe. The term religion, as they referred to it, these organized Christianity, they had never seen it done quite to that extent. And he remarked that nowhere else in the universe had they seen that happen. His biggest problem with it was, he says, that Christianity had distorted the truth so much that it was interfering, really, with people's ability to learn. That people were coming into society because of the environment or family they may be born into. They are exposed to Christianity. They are taught Christianity. They believe that what Christianity is telling them. And it becomes like it's a hampering force. It keeps the individual from actually ever getting a chance to understand the truth. That it's not really so difficult to understand the truth about life and so forth, that it exists in nature around us all the time. That the observant person can come to understand more about life if he was just left alone. But in most cases, especially in the Christian world, that's not possible. But that wasn't going to be possible while he's in eternity.